Experiences in Alaska by Ben Guile, November 92.
I think that when you talk about coming, many of the parts of your life that happened, and I'm not different from most people, I came to Alaska from somewhere else. Probably 90% of the people living in Alaska today are in that same position. We came from someplace else. I was born in a little town called Dover Foxcroft, Maine, and we were farm people. I was born in 1924. Of course, the Big Depression happened in 1928, and the whole country went to pieces economically. I remember my grandfather, who owned the farm, saying that it didn't pay to raise potatoes because you couldn't get more than 10 cents a barrel for potatoes, and then you had to haul them to market. It cost you more to raise them and dig them and pick them and barrel them and take them to town than you could get for them. We raised stock, of course, but Maine is particularly a potato country, and we had a potato farm. We raised other vegetables, of course, for our own use. It's very much like Alaska in that rurally we did a lot of hunting. We ate very little store-bought meat. I didn't get a store-bought suit of clothes until I was 17. From the time I was a child until I left home, my mother made all my clothes, as she made all the other clothes in the family. And as I look back, I look forward to getting that store-bought suit, but now, as I recall, it was very inferior to what she made me at home. Well, I'll admit, one year she made me a Buster Brown suit when I was in the fourth grade. And I kept trying to tell her that I couldn't fight good enough to wear that suit to school. But she made me wear it anyway, and I had 50 fights before I got home, and it was completely torn off me. Because the kids would make fun of me, and I'd get right in the middle of it. We probably won't use a lot of this stuff, but these are the type of things that bring you into Alaska. Alaska has always been a magic name for me. I first learned of Alaska as a pre-teen youth in reading Jack London's stories and stories of the North and so forth, and the Yukon, and the Gold Rush, and the Chilkoot Trail. Oh, it was always something on my mind. I was a chronic runaway when I was a kid. We moved to Massachusetts because there was no work in Maine at all, and I really hated it. And so every chance I got, I went back to Maine. I ran away four times before I was 14, starting when I was about 10. And when I was 14, I ran away and went to sea and ended up in Spain in 1938. Not that trained me for going to Alaska, but it was an experience that most people don't have, and it was something that, this was the Spanish Civil War. And it was something that is indelible on my mind, and still is, for 54 years. 1940-41, I was in Maine at an NYA trade school in Eastport, NYA being the National Youth Administration. This was President Roosevelt's attempt to take all of the school dropouts and educate them in a trade. It was a trade school. and I was being trained in aviation engine mechanics. Pearl Harbor happened, of course, on the 7th of December in 1941. I tried to join the Army Air Corps, and I was too young, and my mother wouldn't sign for me. So I forged a birth certificate and went across to Canada and joined the RCAF, four of us. I was in training in Hamilton, Ontario to be a sergeant pilot when they found out I was only 17. And they ran me out of Canada, but by that time I was close enough to 18 so that as soon as I attained my 18th birthday, I joined the Army Air Corps, U.S. My grandfather, who owned the farm in Duval Foxcroft, the same farm that he was born on in 1844, he died in 1942 at 94. Grandma preceded him in death by 3 weeks. She was 87. And upon her funeral, he went home and went to bed and died 3 weeks later. There wasn't nothing left for the man. I haven't been back to Maine since then. I still consider myself a Mainonite or a maniac, whatever, whichever way you want to look at it. But 1942, in the Army Air Corps, we made a training flight from the East Coast to the West Coast. I was in Greenville, South Carolina, and we flew to California, and then from California and Washington, Oregon, on up to Alaska, and landed at Ladd Field in Anchorage, where the site of Fort Rich is now. We weren't here long enough for me to put any roots down, but I've been trying to get back to Alaska ever since. And one thing or another came up, and I didn't arrive here for good until 1969. Alaska is everything to me that I always thought it was, it would be. It is absolutely the end place, as far as I'm concerned, to live. It has everything. I was talking to this young lady earlier and mentioned the fact that most people that come to Alaska came here because they wanted to have a lifestyle, a standard of living, and a type of living that they were used to in the rural communities of the lower 48. And this is about the only place left that you can do that, not in Anchorage, but in the environs of Anchorage, and of course in Fairbanks and other parts of Alaska, including southeastern Kodiak, some parts of south central. The cities are small enough so that you have the familiarity of neighbors, yet large enough so that you can still attain a degree of privacy if you wish. Alaska has changed, as you know, in the last 10, 15 years. I'm not an old timer because I say I've only been here since 69. But I remember when you could walk off and leave your house unlocked and nobody bothered it. I remember in Alaska when you could be skiing, cross-country skiing or dog sledding. And I don't mention snowmobiles or four-wheelers because we didn't have them. Or if they were, they were very, very few. They weren't a nuisance. But if you came on a cabin and you were cold, you went inside, you built a fire in the stove, and you chopped wood and replenished what you used. If you used the food out of the cupboard, you took some food out of your pack and put it back in the cupboard. You left the guy a note and said, "Thank you, I used your cabin. It's very nice. I appreciate it." You left it the way you found it. That has changed in Alaska. I think that's changed because the people we are getting into Alaska now don't know of a way of life and a standard of living that we had in rural America. There is no rural America anymore, as to speak of. And television came in the 50s, and television has changed the world in our outlook on what the world should be and what the world really is and what we perceive society and the world to be. And so we've come to Alaska with the same ideals, and when we get up here, we do our best to live the same kind of life that we lived in Topeka or Houston or Boston or LA or where the hell ever we came from. And in that respect, Alaska has changed drastically in the last 15, 20 years.
Did you do when you first came to Palm? Is that where you first
No, came? I first came into Alaska, into Chugiak, and I stayed with a friend of mine. He was a registered guide, and he'd come to the Lower 48 and put on booking shows. I had hunted in British Columbia and Yukon Territory in Canada before. I was teaching at Michigan State University, and I had a small business of my own on the side. And I was teaching in the public schools, and it was just convenient for me to... Actually what happened is I had a heart attack, and the doctor told me that I had 2 years to live, and so I better get my affairs together. So I said, well, if that's the case, I've always wanted to go to Alaska, and by God, I'm going to Alaska. And he said, if you go to Alaska, you won't live 2 years. And that was 1969.
Hmm.
And it was wrong. But anyway, I came into Chugiak and then moved down to Peters Creek. The first 5 years I did nothing but hunt and fish and photograph and write. That's what I came to Alaska for. I have 3 books in print. They're mushroom books, the definitive work for Alaska fungi, the Alaska Mushroom Hunter's Guide. It's, I think, well known in the university. I know it is around Anchorage area and in southeastern as well. I put in 2 supplemental texts. One was a book of little-known species that are apparent here in Alaska called the Alaska Psychoactive Mushroom Handbook. And this dealt with the 14 so-called mind-reacting species of mushrooms that grow here. And then the other book was almost on request by a number of young people who were homesteading, as they called it, living off the bush, living in the wild. They wanted some information on how to grow your own mushrooms. So I, about a year after the psychoactive book, I put out the homegrown mushrooms in Alaska or anywhere else and how to cook them. And this was just a little how-to chapbook that told these kids how they could, with a couple of bushels of horse manure and a plywood box or an old wash tub or whatever, and $15 in the spawn, could grow $200 worth of mushrooms. So it appealed to their sense of economy. But they've been reasonably successful. The Alaska Mushroom Hunter's Guide went through 3 printings. It's now out of print, and I'm in the process of revising and updating it. And it'll go from 101 mushrooms to about 350 to 400 mushroom species.
Wow.
The other 2 books, I'm leaving them as they are, and they are almost sold out. So they probably won't be reprinted again.
Does your interest in mushrooms come from your farming days in Maine?
I think so. When I was in Massachusetts, the short time that I was telling you about, 1931 and 32 and 33, when I was just 8, 9, 10-year-old kid, the average laboring man was getting a dollar a day. And I found the little town called Woburn, Massachusetts, was 4 miles from Reading, which is 12 miles north of Boston. This will give you the idea of where I lived. There was a furniture factory in Woburn that failed because of the Depression, and it was 4 stories. So this guy in Boston bought out the old furniture building, had it stripped completely inside, and the upper 3 stories he used as storage, and the basement he put in a mushroom growing factory, a mushroom plant. And I would bicycle from Reading to Woburn and pick mushrooms in this mushroom plant. You had to have miner's lights and so forth, you know, just like, because it was very dark. Not that mushrooms require dark. They will grow in light, but they grow better in the dark. And other things don't grow in the dark, so they help the mushrooms that way. He paid 5 cents a 2-pound box of mushrooms. And when the mushrooms were flushing, as we call them, growing in profusion, I'd earned as much as $3, $4 a day. Had a nickel a 2-pound box. So I was picking 50, 60 2-pound baskets of mushrooms. Where, like I say, a man working 10 hours a day and picking shovels earning a dollar a day on the WPA. So it was a really good job, and I kind of got interested in mushroom culture then, although it laid dormant pretty much. After World War II, I used the GI Bill and went to college. I was an engineering student. I found out that I had to take a biological science course as an elective to be a well-rounded engineer. I couldn't get into the general biology course because it was crowded. So I took a general microbiology course, and it was just like a light turned on. And I changed my major from engineering into microbiology, and I graduated into microbiology and public health. Went on, got my master's in the same field, and then finally, for my own edification more than anything else, I went ahead and finished my doctorate in engineering biological science, biology engineering. And this dealt with using primarily in corrosion engineering, a sulfite reducing bacteria in anaerobic soils, and it's nothing that I will go into, but that primarily is a major cause of corrosion in sour oil fields.
Was mushroom farming a lucrative business? I mean, was it a hard business to make money at, or?
Oh no, there's something very mysterious about mushrooms. They immediately, when I say mushroom, what does it conjure in your mind? The toad sitting on a mushroom, the little fairy, the elves in a field of mushrooms.
Mm-hmm.
Look at all of your fairy tale books. When they have these little elves and fairies in the forest, what do they have growing on the ground around the trees and so forth? Mushrooms. It's a very mysterious plant, but it's a vegetable, just like any other vegetable.
Hard to grow, easy to grow?
No. They grow where you don't want them to grow, and you try to get them to grow, and you can't make them grow. You've got to have very optimum conditions to grow mushrooms. And Mother Nature is the only one so far that knows exactly these conditions.
Did you do most of your research around Tree Gap?
When I came to Alaska, that's the first thing I noticed was a great lack of information in the biological sciences, and particularly the primitive plants. And it just seemed a natural thing to do for me, being interested in the fungi. It took me 2 years to actually do the field work for that book, and it took me another 2 years to get it published. It took me about a year to get the illustrations. And when it was published, it was very successful. It was on the bestseller list in Alaska for 2 years, in 78 and 79. And by 79, I did the first revision. And then in 82 or 83, I did the second revision. And came out into the third edition at that time. So they've been, it sold about 25,000 copies within the state. Of course, it sold some outside too, but most of the sales were inside Alaska. It's been quite a popular book, and I've been very gratified with it. And as I say, I'm in the process now of updating it and revising it to include maybe 350, 400 or more species.
How did you get into bear guiding?
Oh, just one of those natural things that happened. I like to hunt and fish, and a friend of mine was in the need of an assistant guide.
He got it all.
So I worked with him mostly on moose and caribou in the Alaska Peninsula. And then we came down to Kodiak and for spring bear over at Zachar Bay, and I was with him 3 years over there.
Did Kodiak look the same?
Oh no, it's changed a lot. It's changed an awful lot. Population has increased tremendously in 20 years. Out at Spruce Cape, I could have bought land for $3 an acre. You know, $300 an acre. Now it's $30,000 a lot, about a quarter an acre.
Really?
So that's what's happened in 20 years here.
How was the lifestyle different?
Oh, we were not so hectic then. Everything was so much easier. So, not lackadaisical, because people were just as intent on making a living, but wasn't such a cutthroat economy, a big business. We weren't computerized. Say what you will, I think the computers have done a lot, but they've done a lot to ruin too. There's been a lot of benefits from computers, but you know, I'm just old-fashioned enough not to. I'm that old dog you can't teach new tricks to, I guess.
What are some of your happier moments?
Oh, I've never had a sad moment in Alaska. I think it's all been good. No, I don't mean to give the impression that I'm displeased with Alaska at all. It's like, as I said previously, it's everything that I've always thought it was, and I'll never leave it. It's great. There's no place like it in the world. There's still unlimited opportunity here. But if I had anything to say against Alaska, it's that we're getting too much pressure from outside on social reforms, government rule, and we're bringing these same ideas that actually ruined the country in the lower 48, we're bringing them into Alaska and ruining Alaska the same way.
Lifestyle back then, rugged or like Jack London depicted? Or?
Well, it always has been. Rural Alaska, Kodiak is not rural. It really isn't, not even out at Narrow Cape or Land's End or Chiniac. It's not rural. They have electricity, they have running water and inside plumbing, and some of the villages still don't have running water and inside plumbing, and some of them not even electricity. This may sound strange, but there are remote villages in Alaska that are not modern. That doesn't really make them any better. Makes them quaint, I suppose. But I was in Barrow in 1970. I was in Kotzebue the same year, Unalakleet, Gullivan. Went across Norton Sound in an open boat with an Eskimo in 1971. It was 160 miles and with an outboard.
Frightening?
No, I thought it was great. But the people live different. Elam is a little village there in the Bering Sea, Norton Sound of the Bering Sea. St. Lawrence Island, the people are living there much like in the much like they lived 50, 7500 years ago. There's been some improvements. But sewage has been the big problem in the villages. There's no place to put it. No place to dig it. You can't put in a sewer system per se because you can't get the lines deep enough. And besides, there's permafrost. 3 feet, 4 feet below the surface, or right up to the surface in many places. So it's very difficult to modernize villages like that, locations like that. Modernize them to the extent that we know what modernization is. Creature comforts of running water and flush toilets and electric lights and gas heat or oil heat.
You think it was easier back then or any better than the creature comforts we have now?
I think, quote, easy is a relative term. Back then, I think it was easy because that's what we had. It's like my mother evolving from a scrub board to a gasoline-powered washing machine. You see? The early washing machines had a gasoline engine on them. You had to start them and had a little Briggs and Stratton. Had to put gas in the tank and had a pull starter and that's what ran your washing machine. That was really an innovation because you went from the scrub board to it. Then when the electric washing machine came out, everybody sighed with relief, and then you didn't have to put gasoline in an engine anymore or pull the starting cord. See? And as these improvements went on and on, in the early 20s when the radio came out, it was absolutely stupendous. Everybody in town would turn out because only one house in town had a radio, so we'd all go over to their place on weekends and listen to the radio. Now we look at radio, look at television, it's on all day, you know. It just sits there and blares. And we don't give it a second thought. But as late as 1950, television was a wondrous thing. That was 30 years ago.
Were any old friends or any of those people back? Have you kept in contact with?
At my age, most of my friends my age are gone. Some are not, but I have not kept in touch with people. The last time I was in Maine was 1974 for a week. My mother is still alive, but she's in Virginia, or in Maryland. I'll be 99 in March. There may be hope for me yet.
What about your guiding days? How long did you guide?
3 years.
3 years. Yeah. How did you like that?
Oh, it was great.
What about the people that you were guiding for?
The guy I work for is fine. The people that he had, I got out of it because I just didn't like the babysitting job.
Yeah.
And most guides get out of it for that reason. It's lucrative, it's good money in it, but it's very satisfying.
What did you do after that?
Well, I, like I say, for the first 5 years I was in Alaska, I hunted and fished and photographed and wrote. I sold about 130 magazine articles. And those three books I told you about, still couldn't make a living. So I said to myself, what can I do? What kind of a job can I take where I'll have as much time off as I need to do my writing and hunting and fishing and photography and still make a decent wage? Go to work for the government. The biggest employee in Alaska is the federal government or the state government or the municipality government. But ultimately the government is the biggest employee in Alaska. So I traded off, like most of us do, a trade. And I traded off my freedom, if you want to call it that, or a little temporary inconvenience, and went to work for Uncle Sam.
Where was that at?
In Anchorage. And I, for about 12, 13 years, I worked nothing but remote sites.
How did you like the site work?
Great.
Did you get to go around and look around all the different
sites? Yeah, I was on 11 different sites.
What were they like?
Out of the 18. Very primitive. In the wintertime, you wouldn't get mail or fresh milk or vegetables for 6 weeks, you know. You were stuck there. You couldn't get off. Suicide rate, the marriage attrition rate was 40% of the site personnel. A few minutes ago I was talking about working on remote sites for the United States Air Force. Started out working in carpentry, and actually I started with the government working for the Alaska Railroad. I went up to Healy on the B&B 8 crew, and we built the section house at Healy. It was 55 below zero when we were working outdoors. And I'd worked for them about 3 months, and all of a sudden I got a call from the Air Force recruiter there in Anchorage. Said that I wanted to know if I wanted to go to work for the United States Air Force, and I said, absolutely. It couldn't have been worse than working at Healy. So I moved into Anchorage, and the job consisted of working as a carpenter out on the remote sites. There's Cape Romanzoff and Tin City and Cape Newingham and Kotzebue and Nome and so forth, King Salmon, Galena. And it was really great, and you got to see a lot of the country that I probably normally wouldn't have seen as a civilian. Even though I was a civilian employee with the Air Force. These are places in Alaska that you don't normally get to. I had gotten to St. Paul and down in the Pribilofs on a writing assignment from a magazine one time. I went down where they were harvesting the seals and did an article and so forth. And then the editor wouldn't take it because my viewpoint, he wanted me to go down and get pictures of how cruel it was, and my viewpoint, it wasn't cruel at all. It's just a means to harvest a product. And so he spent a lot of money and gave me a nice vacation, but he didn't make it clear to me that this is what he wanted, was a biased article on the cruelty to the seal population.
Did you not think that that would diminish the population the way they were doing it?
No, that's a normal harvest. In fact, I think that hunting is a proper game management tool in big game management. I think the sport hunting is a proper tool in game management. 1971, we killed over 300 moose on the Alaska Railroad between Willow and Fairbanks. And that's been consistent almost every year, but nobody makes a hue and cry about that.
Yeah, that would seem more cruel.
Well,
is it?
At any rate, the years that I spent out on the remote sites were very revealing to the Alaskan climb and made me even more eager to stay in Alaska and to see all of Alaska that I could. In the short time that I've been here, the 23 years, I've probably seen more of Alaska than 90% of the so-called Alaskans. Everywhere from Barrow to Shimia. People don't realize it, that when you're in Shimia, you're still in Alaska, and you're closer to Tokyo than you are to Anchorage. You don't realize that. It gives you the size of the state, something to think about.
Do you have a favorite spot in Alaska out of all these places you've visited?
Yes, I do. I would say Kodiak. I don't think there's a prettier place in Alaska than in Kodiak, but I like the sea. I like the green forests. I like the rocks. I don't mind the fog and the rain. I think probably if I were a single man, I would retire right here in Kodiak. I'm getting to the age where the winter gets to me quite a bit. And I would probably be a snowbird, but I would be back in Alaska in the spring. Stay through the summer. But I also like where I live in Peters Creek, outside of Anchorage. We've got a little 5-acre homestead there that we've had since 62. My wife had it before I married her in 81. And it's beautiful. It's right at the edge of the mountains. It's between Chugiak and Palmer, right there at Mirror Lake. And it's lovely. We've got greenhouses, and the house that's right in the middle of the 5 acres.
Oh, nice.
With trees all around it. Isolated. It's really great.
Are you able to grow mushrooms in your greenhouses?
Oh, yeah. One of my retirement projects is to put in a special mushroom propagation house, and I'll raise four different species of mushrooms that I'll probably sell to restaurants in Anchorage.
Would mushrooms grow in Kodiak?
Oh, there's a lot of mushrooms in Kodiak, sure. There's, in my 5-acre yard, there's 65 species of mushrooms that I've collected and cataloged and so forth, just in this 5 acres, different seasons of the year. We eat a lot of mushrooms.
Are they good for you?
Yes, very. Lots of vitamins, lots of minerals. Lots of very little vitamin C, but really tremendous. Like most vegetables.
In the early days when you went to the remote sites, did you go by ship then?
No, flew. Yeah. Working for the Air Force, you fly.
Let's go.
Have any favorite memento, any possessions from the early days?
In 1969, I drove over the Alcan, and when I hit Haines Junction, I went south to Haines. It took me about a month and a half to get to Alaska because I stopped and fished every stream that crossed the road and every lake that I saw and visited every village, and I just enjoyed myself, and went down to Port Chilicoot and took the Chilicoot Trail, you know, on into Canada, where the White Pass and Railroad is, only I hiked up over the trail and so forth. And on the Canadian side of the Chilicoot Trail, I forget the name of the lake, Stevens, I think. There was a big lake there where they used to build their boats. and go down. But at any rate, an old cabin that was burned, partially burned and knocked down, in rummaging around and looking for this and that, I found a knife, the ivory tusk handle, and I still have that knife. It's a particular good memento. I have a lot of ivory from Tin City, the trading post out at Tin City in Golovin, out in the Bering Sea area, St. Lawrence Island. I have ivory mementos and collections from there. I have a lot of baskets, baleen, and things like that in our collection. Tremendous amount of Alaskan art, different Alaskan artists. Our house is full of it, and we enjoy that.
How did you like the Pribilofs? What did you think of
it? I didn't really stay there long enough. I would like to stay, say, 6 months or a year. It takes that long for the people to get used to you. You have a set standard of living and a set social pattern. And a Cossack, a white man, interrupts this. And so it takes a little while. But I'm one of the very fortunate people that I seem to be able to get along with most everybody. It doesn't take me long to make friends. I can truthfully say I don't think I've made any enemies in the time I've been in Alaska. I get along with most everybody. But you have to bend to do this. You have to realize that they're not like you, or they're not like other people that you've come in contact with. And so you look at their way of life and bend to it. You eat what they eat, and you sleep where they sleep, and you live where they live, and you don't look down on them because they're not up to your standards.
Find their culture...
In many respects, their culture is completely of survival. That's the main drive, to survive. And they do what is necessary to survive, which means hunt and clothe themselves and feed themselves and house themselves. That's their main drive. If it's been spoiled, we've spoiled it. We've introduced liquor, alcohol. We've introduced rock and roll music, and we've introduced TV. And I think it's ruined the culture in that respect. Because they can't seem to adjust to it. But
the natives different, say, like from the southeast area natives, or?
Yes, the cultures are entirely different. The Eskimos and the Aleuts and the Athabascans and the Tlingits and the Haida, they're all different. The Athabascans are more like the Canadian Indians, Sioux and the northern lower 48, northern U.S. states Indians, the Sioux and the Blackfeet and the Crow, Yukon Indians. The Eastern American Indians, the Iroquois and the Chippewa, and so forth. And of course in the West, the Navajos and the Apache, they're entirely different. And they're not at all like any of the Northwestern Indians. But the Haida and the Tlingits of Southeastern are much like the Indians of the Canadian West. the Eskimo is unique. Eskimo is entirely unique. He's more Russian, Mongolian. Which I suppose if I were an anthropologist would justify the land bridge theory. But the Indians of Alaska, the Athabascan particularly, is the woodland Indian. He's the woodland Indian.
It's the Bering Sea land bridge?
Yeah, coming across from Russia to Alaska, that way and down. That's what, 15,000 years ago,
mm-hmm.
20,000 years ago, a little before my time.
Oh.
I'm not that old. Greg, we had a young GI out at King Salmon. We were sitting there having coffee one day, and he says, "Well, I don't know how old Mr. Guile is, but he got gigged for having having buffalo shit in his flintlock." Can't put that in the report.
What kind of animals have you run across? Did you see any muskox?
Yeah, I was in Nunavak. And I've seen muskox there. Of course, I've also seen them at Nome and at Palmer. And it's very discouraging to see them all penned up in a pen. We call it biological research, and we put collars around their necks and inject them with dyes and tab their ears. And I'm talking about elk and moose and deer and for the sake of research and all it is job security. It's just a bunch of people justifying their jobs. They're not doing us any good. They ought to leave Mother Nature alone. Like the ad says, you can't fool Mother Nature. Let Mother Nature take care of herself. On the other hand, with the influx of populations of peoples, we have to have game laws, we have to have... But I'd like to see Alaska come back to the age when you needed meat, you went out and hunted it.
Yeah.
If you didn't need it, you didn't shoot it. If you shot it, you kept it and cleaned it and ate it. You didn't sell it for booze or dope. But that's just wishful thinking.
So what do you think about the future of Alaska?
I think it's got a great future if you can keep it on an even keel and keep government politics out of it. The trouble is, you take the king's money, you do the king's bidding. When I was at Michigan State, I taught in the medical school. I taught bacteriology to nurses. About that time, we were developing this big med school that we have now, because the University of Michigan has a med school, always has. But MSU wanted to put in a med school. So they needed $23 or $24 or $25 million in order to build this school. So they got it from the U.S. government. One of the first edicts from the U.S. government was that 20% of the freshman class had to be non-white, and they were guaranteed graduation.
Hmm. Do you think that has to do with the same principle with the Anwar and the oil?
No, I think what we have here in the Anwar, we have an area that has a tremendous potential for oil development, but we got a bunch of posy sniffers, as your husband calls them, that don't want to see any kind of development like this. These are the same people that would stop a productive damming of a river to create hydraulic energy to produce electricity, for example, into areas that need it. Because there's a species of fish that won't grow anywhere else. I don't believe in the immortality of species. We're not immortal. And I just don't believe in the immortality of species. It's nice that we've brought the eagle back. It's nice that we've brought the trumpeter swan back. It's nice that the muskox is no longer an endangered species. It's also good that the grizzly bear and the mountain lion are coming back, and the wild turkey. This is great. I think it's fine. We'll never get the passenger pigeon back. For that, I'm sorry. But see no great calamity. Did the same thing in our oil. How can people be conservation-minded when the state of California has more automobiles than the whole continent of Europe? And they have more automobiles than the whole eastern seaboard of the United States. And are burning gasoline up 10 times the rate of all the rest of the United States. They're consuming petroleum fuels. One state. And yet, these people scream and holler because we have a stickleback fish or a, what's the owl down in Oregon? Spotted owl, see? That's endangered.
You think there was more animals back when you first came here? No.
I think we have 10 times as many now.
So you think it's
Alaska's a big state, and we have probably more animals in the state per acre than any other state, but the space is so large between, we just don't see them that much. Just because you don't see a lot of moose, for example, or a lot of bear, or a lot of fox, or anything else, doesn't mean that they're not there. They have areas to get away from people, and they will try to get away from people. It's not the nature of wildlife to live with people. And even yet today, in the middle of the winter, a moose will not stay out in the deep snow. He comes where the snow's been plowed, so he walks right down Fifth Avenue in Anchorage. We're still having moose on the streets. And in the later years, we've had a lot of grizzly come into Anchorage, particularly South Anchorage along the Muldoon Tudor area, on the mountains going out into Turnagain Arm. There's been four or five grizzly sightings in the last couple of years. We've had moose in our backyard every winter. Used to have a lot of bear, but we haven't seen a bear since that brown bear was killed in Eagle River, killed by a truck. What was it, 76? But I think an area is a lot more interesting with a grizzly than without one. I have a place down on the Alaska Peninsula at Presheroff Lake. I filed on in 1973. And I've had as many as 9 brown bear right in my backyard, and I don't hunt them.
You just take pictures of them?
No, not necessarily. They're just there. I'm not there all the time. But I've had as many as 9 brown bear in my vicinity. In my backyard, so to speak, is within a mile of camp.
You don't think the population of people is overrunning? Or
not down there.
Crowding out there?
Not down there. That's wide open. Very little people down there. Very few people. Anchorage is the only populated place in Alaska. It has, what do we got, 500,000 people in the whole state? And half of those people live in Anchorage. Got the biggest state in the United States.
Did you like, when you first came here back then, that's not here now?
I like the peace and quiet. the old Glen Highway from Palmer to Anchorage, you seldom saw more than a few automobiles, and then only on weekends. Now it's bumper to bumper from Peters Creek, Chugiak, Eagle River to Anchorage. The Glen 500 from Eagle River to Anchorage, we call it. Demolition Derby. Or snow of every year, we've averaged 75 fender benders. I was home over Armistice Day, Veterans Day. They had a foot of snow. There were 13, 14 cars in the ditch. I don't know how to drive. All the population in Anchorage right now, 60% have been there less than 5 years. I met one of these bureaucrats recently, a GS-12 working for government bureau there in Anchorage. And in Alaska, 21, 22 years. Into Alaska about the same time I did, maybe a little before, a little after. We've been out of Anchorage. I said, man, you haven't been in Alaska 21 years. You've been in Alaska one time. You've been in Alaska 1 year 21 times. But to get back to your question, the snow machine, the three and four wheelers, the ATVs, and the attitude of the people who drive them is what is different and is what has saddened me from when I came here. You don't dare leave your house unlocked. If you leave the state, you have to put a watchman on your house, hire somebody to take care of it, which is not a bad idea anyway, because your furnace might fail or something go out and everything all freeze up. So it's best to have someone look after your house anyway, but now you've almost got to hire somebody to live in your house while you're gone for any length of time. Alaska always was an expensive place to eat, to live. Expense is relative. You didn't mind paying a little more for food. You didn't mind paying a little more for transportation. You didn't mind paying a little more for gasoline and oil, because you derived the benefits of being here in Alaska. And the benefit of being here offset the cost. And it's somewhat the same right now. I enjoy Kodiak very much. It's 25% over what it would cost me to live in Anchorage. But I think the benefits of being here in Kodiak are worth it. I don't have any qualms.
And some of the benefits include the peace and quiet. And
the peace and quiet and the ocean and the scenery and the environment and the people. The people that are not supposed to be here are soon weeded out. The law either arrests them and takes them out of here in chains, or they die. Or they screw up and get killed because of idiocy. They're idiots, and they don't survive. But that's the way it's always been in a frontier, rural environment. Survival is the key. And some people survive at the handle end of a gun because they can't make it any other way. And if I have any qualms whatsoever about Alaska, it's that fact that I will not be able to protect my home and my family and myself, because the law will say that I can't do it.
You think Alaska still has that frontier flavor?
Absolutely. there are people that want to take it away from us because they want to change it to the way it was in East Podunk or wherever they came from, in the lower 48. They screwed it up down there. Now they're coming up here and they want to do the same thing.
So you think there's a certain type of people that remain?
Yes. Yeah, and those people we want. The people that remain here are hardworking. We have the highest level of intellect of any state in the United States. We have the highest level of education. We may not always work in the jobs that we've been trained for. That's one of the unique things about being Alaskan. You can do whatever you want to do. Whatever you're qualified to do.
How's your coffee been?
That'll be cool. I'll get yakking. We're changing, Darlene, but I think there's going to be, in the whole United States, and I think in Alaska too, there's a big social revolution going on. And we're just going to have to find our way. It's not going to be done just because everybody does it. I'm not a religious bigot. I think that there's a place in society for religion, if you want it. I'm not a social bigot. I believe that there's a place in society for all races and creeds, but not one should be benefited over another. We should all have the same equal opportunity.
Think that's changed?
Absolutely. We've bent over backwards, for example, in the Indian preference thing, native giveaway, land giveaway, the native land claims. Never in the history of mankind such a claim been settled until now. I don't recall the exact figure, but five lawyers in New York City, New York, not Alaska, five lawyers in New York City got over $9 million settlement when they settled the land claims for the natives of Alaska. $9 million, their fee.
Has that had any effect on your land?
I've been fighting them for 20 years. I just got it. It's only because of my persistence. It better has had an effect on my land. And I've had all kinds of native Alaskan, I don't mean native.